walk the streets are screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to continue our look at the past. We're going to continue this introspection of what happened in 2019, because what happened in the past will tell you, in part at least, what's going to happen in the future. 2020 is going to be a very interesting year. And we want to look at the past year, 2019. We started this last week, but we want to look at it in a little bit more detail. What's happened? What are the 10 top events of the past year in the U.S. economy? And broaden that a little bit. What are the 10 top events in the global economy in 2019? I also want to talk about technology in relationship to this 10 most important events of past year in the U.S. And then next week, we'll broaden it out a little bit and do another summary on the 10 most important U.S. and global events last year in politics, global politics. And of course, today we know a very interesting development is going on. Looks like as we approach the impeachment, we're getting some foreign policy crises distractions here. Why would Trump assassinate the leading general in Iran if he didn't want to provoke some kind of a crisis over there? So, you know, the politics continue, and it's going to be a very interesting year here, since also today we have a notification that U.S. manufacturing really contracted even more sharply than it had in each of the previous 4 months. So we got 5 months of contraction now going on in the manufacturing sector. Of course, we have a global manufacturing recession that's been underway for some time. Now the U.S. is firmly in that. The contraction today was the worst since June 2009, over a decade ago, at the end of the last recession there, official recession. Pretty ominous, and I think we're going to see a continuation as well of the contraction in the U.S. economy of real investment, you know, in plant and equipment and so forth, and structures. That's going to continue. It's already contracted the second and third quarters of last year, so certainly that and durable goods will contract as we get the data here soon in coming weeks for the fourth quarter of last year. So we've got manufacturing contracting even faster and real investments slowing even faster, contracting actually, you know, and yet we get all this Pollyanna reports going on. Oh, the economy in the U.S. is in a good spot. It's in a good place. Yeah, that's because the stock markets are booming. We'll talk about that. And the rich are getting much richer off of their financial assets. And we get a lot of this phony talk about, oh, wages are rising. Well, read my latest entry on my blog. You know, those questionable 3.1% wage increase statistics again. I've been talking about that on occasion here this past year. Take a look at my blog, jackrasmus.com, for my analysis and all these other independent surveys that are giving a different picture about the wage increase spin that's going on here. So stock markets are booming, going through the roof, and continuing, by the way, although today it's a little bit of a off day, a little bit because of what's going on in Iran and Iraq, and probably according to the manufacturing data contracting. You know, we want to talk about, let's recap and elaborate a little bit on the 10 top economic developments of last year in the U.S., and then add to it some new discussion of the 10 top economy developments last year in a global economy. Global. So U.S. and global. What are the 10 most important events of last year? Well, looking at the U.S. once again, as I started talking last week, the Fed, the central bank, Federal Reserve, did an about-face in January of last year under pressure from the other bankers and Trump to stop raising interest rates. And that raises the question of all this phony talk of central bank independence, and also the phony spin we get about central banks not being concerned about financial asset markets, only the real economy. You know, their mandate is real growth and real employment. Well, as I pointed out in my prior book, Central Bankers Under the Rope, you know, that's myth, that's fiction. The central bank, the Fed, often responds to financial asset markets. And it's not independent, and it's big strategic shifts. Maybe it's day-to-day 0.25% changes. The Open Market Committee of the Fed makes the decisions, but the big changes are politically motivated. And we saw that very clearly last year in December of 2018 when we had a big contraction of the financial markets, stock markets in the U.S., 30%. And panic almost set in, and bankers and big business started putting pressure on the administration. And Trump, of course, that fit very well with his attempt to boost the economy as it entered into the last year of his first term for election purposes. So they did pull it off, and the Fed reversed course, stopped raising rates, and then cut rates, I think, three times last year. Rates meaning the federal funds rate that influences other rates. And, you know, the banks like that because they can borrow much more cheaply from the Fed and then lend it to other sources that then investors of various kinds, institutional and individual, that then buy more stocks and bonds. So everybody makes money when rates are low. Plus, as I've said on other occasions, multinational corporations, U.S. abroad, like lower interest rates because the low rates keep the dollar low, and that enables them to repatriate even more profits made in foreign currencies when they convert to the U.S. dollar lower because rates are lower, and they bring the profits back home. So U.S. multinationals that have really expanded under neoliberalism offshore do a lot of business offshore in foreign currencies, like low rates, low dollar. And those are two important policy objectives of neoliberalism, which we've been talking about. So Fed rate about face by Powell, Chairman Powell of the Fed, under pressure, big story of 2019, both for truly understanding central banks and what they are about, mainly bailing out banks and bailing out investors, and the politics of all that. Another big story here of last year in the U.S. economy erupted in September, and that was the repo market, repurchase agreements market. Mini crisis erupted. Rates spiked 10%. From 2%, big question, why was that? And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, kind of like a black swan, as they call it, we saw this, or at least a gray swan, we saw this market, an important market, dependent on U.S. Treasuries, stumble significantly. In other words, there wasn't enough dollars and liquidity in that market, which kind of sets the tone for other markets as well. You see, there's two rates now that are Fed rates that are important. Used to be just what was called the federal funds rate, which is what the brokers have to buy and sell treasuries, U.S. treasuries for. That's how the main method by which the Fed pumps money in and out of the economy, the federal funds rate. And all the other interest rates follow suit. You know, mortgage rates, prime rates, and so forth, based upon whether the federal funds rate manipulated by the fan, goes up or down. Well, now we have this second channel here called the repo market, repurchase agreement market, where the Fed buys and sells bonds as well, that influences the increasingly important repo rate, as they call it. So it's a second channel of money going in and out of the economy. And all of a sudden, in September, it ran out of money. So the Fed started pumping money in once again. And the statistics just came out recently, here last couple days, that the Fed has pumped net on net $255 billion into the markets. 250 cents just since September, just in 3 months. So what we got here is a new channel for QE, quantitative easing, where the Fed pumps money in on massive scale. And of course, that massive liquidity injection results in lower interest rates as well. But it means that the Fed is adding more debt to its balance sheet. And that balance sheet now has about $4.2 trillion. It's up about $300 billion, you see, just in a couple months. And at that rate, you know, it's going to be adding $1 trillion a year more on top of its debt. And that's how the Fed bails out banks and the system. It takes their bad debt and puts it on the Fed's balance sheet and puts money at a very attractive cost or no cost into the hands of these investors and these banks. Number one way the Federal Reserve subsidizes the banking system. You know, so watch the debt level, the balance sheet debt level of the central bank. And all central banks do that, you know, in advanced countries, economies. So it's an indication of, oh, we're bailing them out again. And we have a second channel for what's called quantitative easing, direct bailout, going on here once again. And we'll see how unstable that particular market continues to be in 2020. But it was a big story of last year, and the story isn't over. It's not finished. We will possibly see even more instability there going on in 2020. Okay, so two important developments with the Federal Reserve economically in the U.S. last year. Of course, we have the Trump trade wars last year. Very important. We've talked about that time and again here. What my argument from the very beginning was that most of the trade wars were phony trade wars, except for China. And the China trade war was really a trade war covering a tech war. Basically, the phony trade war, look at South Korea, look at the, you know, Europe, look at the Canada, Mexico, just token tweaks of the existing free trade systems here. A lot of smoke, you know, and not much fire. A lot of mirrors here going on. Trump hyperbole and exaggerating things that have been changed when they haven't really been changed very much. With these trade wars, so-called, you know, everywhere else except for China, that was real. But we saw this past year how the neocons, in his trade team, fronting for the U.S. military and complex and defense companies and so forth, were really running the show in Trump trade negotiations with China, because China advances in what's called next-gen technology, 5G wireless, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence. Okay, we see that going on, trade war with China, and the neocons scuttled several times tentative agreements last year with China. And almost tipped the economy, the financial side, into another sharp contraction last August by getting Trump to raise his tariffs after he had promised China President Xi just weeks before he would not. And China, of course, responded by letting its currency devalue, which would offset trade tariffs, you see. China has a lot of weapons to really deal with the U.S., and that led to Trump's calling China back to Washington and in October announcing this phase one of a mini deal with China, which, if you look behind it, is really an agreement with China to buy more farm goods from the U.S. in exchange for the U.S. reducing tariffs on China. But that has been dragging out throughout the rest of 2019. They declared they had an agreement in October, but nothing was signed throughout all 2019 on this, which really means that they're still negotiating and debating over how much tariffs to cut by the U.S. in exchange for how much farm goods China will purchase. You know, no agreement there, really. Well, Trump just a few days ago announced that they would sign something on the 15th of January. Well, it's going to be interesting to see what it is they do sign on the 15th of January, because almost every other day in November and December, Trump and or his administration, you know, representatives, Kudlow or Mnuchin or somebody has been saying, oh, it's coming, you know, oh, we got a deal, you know, just to keep everybody in the investment wing there, not to panic, you know, they're going to get something. Well, we'll see what it is on January 15th, or maybe later, who knows. It won't be much. It won't be much. The trade wars are over, okay? China is not going to agree to anything on technology. That's been decoupled now. And the U.S., of course, in 2020 will continue going after Chinese tech companies, 5G and others, Huawei and ZTE and other companies. And the tech war has begun. The trade war is over. The tech war has begun. Well, it had begun under the cover of the trade war anyway. But that's a big story of last year in the U.S. economy. Okay. U.S. manufacturing recession. Clearly a story of last year, especially in the second half. We now have five consecutive months of U.S. manufacturing contraction. Five consecutive months. And the data just came out today shows the biggest of the five-month contractions in December. The PMI, the index, you know, fell from 48.1 to 47.2. Anything under 50 means contraction. The biggest drop since June 2009. So the U.S. is really part now of manufacturing contraction going on. Global manufacturing recession. Accompanying that recession is the parallel contraction of real investment, real asset investment. I'm not talking about financial asset investment. I'm talking about the real economy and the real investment going on, you know, in plant and equipment and business structures and office buildings and manufacturing facilities, right? Resorts, hotels. That's what's called real commercial construction, which is part of real investment. Inventories, software is in there. But, you know, that's been contracting in the second and third quarters of last year and almost certainly will continue. The data, when it comes out soon, will show contraction in the fourth quarter. So 9 months, excuse me, of contraction in real investment. You know, the real investment is what creates real jobs and real wage incomes for people. The financial investment doesn't create jobs. In fact, it may destroy jobs. Okay, so that's, you know, the fifth important development. And then, of course, the big story last year related to all this is the stock market's boom. The stock market has been booming and continues to be for various reasons. One, of course, the cheaper interest rates to borrow to speculate with by investors. The NASDAQ tech market up 35% over last year. The S&P 500 up almost 30%. The Dow, I think, 24 or 25%. Big bonds boom in the first half of this year. made money in bonds. So what's driving the stock market is an important question. And of course, a number of factors here, not only the cheaper cost of money, but a massive inflow of foreign investment money into the U.S. in search of a safe haven and higher returns, because elsewhere around the world, currencies in many places are contracting, falling, and that means a loss of profits. So people, investors abroad, U.S. and foreign, want to get out of those currencies that are collapsing, you know, whether it's in Argentina or Chile or wherever, and they want to buy foreign currencies, and the best currency is the U.S. Dollar or the Japanese yen. And buying the dollar, well, you're not going to just leave it there. You're going to invest probably in something safe in the markets, or treasury bills or bonds or something, right? So this wall of money flowing in from offshore is driving up stock markets as well, as they invest in stocks. And, of course, bonds as well to some extent. But the tech sector, you know, booming is huge profits by big tech companies driving up the NASDAQ, and mergers and acquisitions, money for that is driving it up. In other words, it's not reflecting money by companies to expand real production, and real production then would hire people and pay wages and so forth. No, it's a financial asset investing and speculation on the prices of financial assets that are driving the stock market boom. And, of course, you know, it appears to be the spin, appears to be the end of the trade wars here. That affects confidence levels of investors and speculators. So that's part of what it is as well, driving the stock markets, right? Another story is Trump's deficits, U.S. federal budget deficits, now admittedly exceed $1 trillion. In fact, they've been over $1 trillion. You know, the actual reporting, which is always lowballing, now you can't hide the fact that we got a $1 trillion U.S. budget deficit, driven largely by the two factors. One is defense spending that continues to rise, and the tax cuts, Trump tax cuts. And to some extent, social program spending continues to rise more modestly, but rise nonetheless, as the Democrats and Trump have a agreement that if you want more defense spending, Mr. Trump, then you got to throw a few more dollars in here in the social program spending. And that's the trade-off the Democrats have come to an agreement with Trump on for the last 3 years. Of course, Trump then turns around and cuts other areas of spending, like cutting 700,000 people out of food stamps. So he offsets that. But as far as the budget is concerned, defense spending, a big factor. Of course, the corporate tax cuts that continue to reduce the corporate income tax and in personal income tax for investors and the wealthy, big time. A story just came out this past week where the New York Times finally admits that Trump's 2018 tax cuts reduced taxes for corporations, businesses, wealthy investors by $5.5 trillion. Over a decade. They got $5.5 trillion. Well, you know, you've been hearing this story, oh, it's tax cuts are $1.5 trillion. And New York Times have been peddling that for 2 years, but now at the end of 2 years, you get this big feature story buried in the middle of the issue saying, oh, it's really $5.5 trillion. The rich folks, you know, how they get to 1.5? Well, they get to 1.5 by saying, oh, the economy is going to grow 3% rate for 10 years and no recession for the next 10 years. And that's going to generate more tax revenues. And they use that phony assumption to offset the $5.5 trillion. Plus, we're going to see a $1.5 trillion hike in tax increases for the middle class as they eliminate all these deductions and exemptions. That's really going to hit hard about 2024. So they're going to take back, offset some of that $5.5 trillion by raising taxes on the rest of us. You know, so that's $3 trillion. And then they $3 trillion to offset the $5.5 trillion. So that leaves what, $2.5 trillion. And then they lowball the estimate for the tax cuts for multinational U.S. corporations offshore, which just for the Fortune 500. I've estimated at least $2 trillion over the next decade, $2 trillion in tax cuts. Well, they're minimizing that. They're not, yeah, because we got rid of the foreign profits tax, and they can keep more profits offshore now. And by the way, you know, the New York Times article really showed how these big, two big loopholes that weren't addressed at all, corporations, guilty, G-I-L-T-I, and there's another one, I forget what it is, the loophole, that allows particularly tech companies, bankers, finance companies, pharmaceuticals, and whatever, to minimize their tax load in the U.S. by counting their profits offshore, in their offshore subsidiaries, where the tax is much lower. And by the way, Europeans are trying to raise those much lower taxes, but the U.S. is putting pressure on Europe. Oh, no, you can't do that. You'll set off a war with us, a tax war with us. We'll do the same to your companies. So, you know, the U.S. is doing all it can to ensure that those loopholes remain offshore. So, you know, the phony estimation of the tax cuts offshore, not talking about or estimating accurately the higher taxes on the middle class coming, and phony assumptions about growth and tax revenues reduces the actual $5.5 trillion in their pocket to $1.5 trillion. You know, but the mainstream press went along with this charade for quite some time, and now we only get the New York Times, again, too little, too late, New York Times, admittance that, oh, it's $5.5 trillion. Well, you know, that those big tax cuts really whack the budget, because 60% of the deficit is due to tax revenues, not spending. Well, that was 2018 and its effect in 2019, but we get even more tax cuts by Trump here last year. We get an action by the U.S. Treasury without going to Congress, you know, cutting taxes another $427 billion. More loopholes, you know, for owners of sports teams and parking lots and things like that, right? All loopholes, special interest loopholes. Well, they extended that and advanced that $427 billion more on top of the $5.5 trillion. Of course, over a decade, so that's like $45 billion more in tax cuts in 2019 that way. On top of the $5.5 trillion. You know, when Trump ran for office, in the spring of 2016, he said, we're going to cut taxes $5.5 trillion. That was his plan. Well, they gave him $5.5 trillion. Well, he fulfilled his plan. Yeah, $5.5 trillion. I've been pointing that out ever since then on my blog. You can, you know, scroll down my blog, jackrasmus.com, and you'll see, you know, at least half a dozen articles where I'm talking about this massive tax cut that he enacted, and now they're continuing. The tax cuts are continuing. By the way, that tax bill was crafted by two guys behind closed doors, quietly, at the end of 2018. Two big bankers, right? Gary Cohn from Goldman Sachs, who was at the time Trump's economic advisor, director of his economic advisor, and, of course, Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, also from Goldman Sachs. Those two guys crafted this bill in late 2017, rather, and they threw it out there, Congress, just before they adjourned and pushed it through, because Republicans, check that, Trump-publicans, control both houses of Congress at that time, and they pushed this thing through and got away with it. But now they're pushing through even more, almost $500 billion. And then that's not counting, you know, the tax cutting going on in the Affordable Care Act as various sources of revenue that were designed to pay for the Affordable Care Act taxes on the rich, you know, the investment tax and the medical tax, device tax, and, you know, those things have been gutted and taken off the table as Trump and the Trump publicans continue, you know, the death of a thousand cuts here of the ACA and getting rid of its financing base. Those are additional tax cuts for wealthy and investors on top of the $427 billion announced last year. Right? And they're talking about trying to make, and Trump will propose this next year, trying to make the $5.5 trillion permanent beyond 10 years. Beyond. Okay, so the Trump tax cuts roll on, a story of 2019. U.S. productivity collapsing once again. Well, that goes along with real investment contracting for 9 months. And when productivity contracts, puts pressure on businesses not giving wage increases or cutting wages, because collapsing productivity raises unit labor costs of businesses. And there's two elements to unit labor costs. One is productivity and one is wages, nominal wages. So when productivity collapses, they try to offset the rise in unit labor costs by reducing in wage increases. Okay, and that's another phony story. I've written about that in great detail, how the 3.1% wage increase is just a phony spin, if there ever was one. And the recent article on my blog, jackrasmus.com, brings in you know, 4 or 5 different surveys that show that you know, this isn't happening. 3.1% isn't happening. And the last 10th event of the U.S. economy last year, the U.S. debt, right? Federal debt, federal budget debt, government, federal government debt, $23 trillion, $23 trillion, up from $10 trillion when Bush, George W. Bush, left office. So, you know, both Trump and Republicans and Democrats are just adding more and more to the debt. You know, it's doubling every 10 years. And my forecast has been that by the end of 2028, it's going to be at least $35 trillion. That's just the federal debt, you see. Then there's state and local government debt. That's at least $5-6 trillion more here. And then there's household debt, which is well above $14 trillion now, you know, led by mortgage debt, about $9 trillion. Credit card debt now well over $1 trillion, auto debt well over $1 trillion, student debt $1.6 trillion and rising. You know, one of the interesting developments of the last 10 years is that the debt level has not been retired. You know, at best it's only creeped up at a slower rate, but of course not for households. Corporate debt, bond debt, you know, for large S&P 500 corporations, $10 trillion, $10 trillion. Yeah. You see, when interest rates are so low, as they chronically have been, as the Federal Reserve has subsidized business, right, what businesses with massive profits have done is sold their bonds to raise even more money. And by raising that even more money, you know, they speculate, they buy back their stock. And as I've said several times on this show, you know, $1.3 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts this year, or 2019, $1.3 trillion. Well, super profits by these corporations, right? Subsidization of interest rate costs, right? Tax cuts, big tax cuts, right? In 2018, I think it was 27% growth in the S&P 500 profits. 22% of that due to Trump tax cuts in 2018. We'll see how much here subsidized their profits growth of this year, you know, which has been, you know, 20-some percent once again. Every year, 20-some every year, right? So low rates, you know, they raise, they sell their bonds. $10 trillion now in corporate debt. Non-financial corporations, $10 trillion, large ones, debt. That's not counting smaller companies raising debt, and it's not counting loans, bank loans, on top of that. So, you know, at least another $5 trillion in smaller company and corporate loan debt. So non-financial corporations' debt, probably $15 trillion. Mm-hmm. And the Federal Reserve, of course, $4 trillion still on its balance sheet. So you take that $4 trillion and $15 trillion of corporate non-financial debt. It's not even counting bank debt. Right, so that's $19 trillion. You take $14 trillion more added to that of household debt, that's $33 trillion. $5-6 trillion in state and local government debt, that's $40 trillion. Federal Reserve, $23 trillion. That's over $60 trillion in debt. In other words, accumulating since the last crisis. Now, as long as the economy is growing, you don't have a economic crisis, most companies can pay off that debt or service it, as they say, or at least pay the interest on it. But when you have a collapse of the real economy, the revenues from their business that they need to pay the principal and interest on that debt is insufficient. And then they either have to get the banks or whoever loaned them that debt to refinance it, roll it over on easier terms, usually extend it out longer. Or if they can't do that, they sell off their company, the best assets at fire sale prices to raise money to pay the debt that they owe because they don't have enough generated revenue to pay the debt. Or they go bankrupt. Default. You see, default is the signal here. And we've got a wide sections of the U.S. corporate economy that are in, that fix. Wide sections. Watch the energy drilling companies, fracking companies, and so forth, energy debt. Watch small manufacturing companies, retail companies in big trouble, going under everywhere. Next recession, watch for companies like Penny's and maybe even Macy's and others to follow the Sears and others that have already gone belly up. And so that's going to be a big problem. Corporations with junk bond debt, like the energy companies and retail companies, they won't be able to make it. And companies with triple B investment grade, which is really junk, other kinds of junk loans, like leverage loans and so forth. There's this mountain just sitting out there waiting to blow, right, like a volcano because of all this excess debt built up, not retired in the last 10 years. 2019, one of the worst years for that debt accumulation. The system runs on debt. Okay. Let's talk about the top 10 global economy events of last year, top 10. Well, clearly we got a global manufacturing recession going on in the U.S., not just in the U.S., global economy recession, manufacturing recession. The U.S., of course, is now clearly part of that. But in Europe, in Germany in particular, even worse off, Japan, flat. China was contracting. They say now it's growing a little bit. But all across the globe, especially in Latin American places like that, we have this big contraction going on in manufacturing. Right? A global trade stagnation. Last I've seen, global trade growth was nearly zero, like somewhere between 0 and 1%. Okay. Other central banks around the world ending their attempt to pull back some of their balance sheet debt or pay some of it off, and now expanding it once again. Europe QE, expanding QE. Japan never even tried to reverse and pay off some of its debt. And of course, the U.S. now with the repo crisis, expanding its debt as well. So the end of what's called QT, quantitative tightening, which is, you know, selling off some of their balance sheet, has ended in 2019. And we're drifting towards another round of QE everywhere, quantitative easing. In other words, the central banks buying up debt and throwing money into the economy. Global stock markets, not just the U.S. stock market last year, but global stock markets doing quite well. As we said, in the U.S., 30 to 35% growth in 19. But elsewhere in the world, even in, you know, economies that are doing so poorly, even worse than the U.S., you know, Japan and Europe, and Latin America, 20 to 25% stock market growth, financial assets. Capitalism in turn to financialization. In other words, all of the money capital is flowing increasingly into financial markets, making money from money instead of making money from things. That's going on. And we see it in these financial asset markets. Continue the boom. Well, there's an inverse relationship between the real economy and the financial economy. You know, the real economy is doing so much poorly because investment's not going there. It's going into financial markets globally. Why? Because financial markets are more profitable faster. Yeah, speculation. And because we have this new finance capital elite of about 200,000 of them, super wealthy people around the world who because of technology, can move their investments around all these liquid markets that exist, financial markets, and they make far more money more quickly and more safely that way than they do in, let's make some things here, which means you got to have suppliers, you got to hire employees, they may go on strike, you know, you may not find the people you want. So the trend has been away from that. I'm not saying it's gone, right? I mean, we've got electric cars and we've got technology and so forth, but not like before. The relative weight between financial investment and real investment has shifted because it's simply more profitable to do financial investment. I wrote about that in great detail in my 2016 book, Financial Fragility in the Global Economy. That's also on my blog, as well as the central bank book. But the latest, of course, is The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. That's available at discount on my blog and website. All of these are related, you see. All these books tell part of the story. You know, global manufacturing recession, global trade stagnation, right? End of QT by central banks, drift now towards the new round of QE. Global stock market surge, $15 trillion in negative interest rates. Negative. In other words, especially in Japan and Europe, you know, if you're a banker or investor, you got to pay the central bank to put your money in the bank. You got to pay them. Okay, $15 trillion. The whole idea of negative rates, what the central bank will pay banks depositing money in the central bank, is to establish a penalty for not lending more, you know, to get the banks to lend more. You know, it's better to lend it out, make a little bit, the logic goes, instead of putting it in the central bank and having to pay the central bank, you know. But it hasn't worked. Because, let's take Europe, for example, the banks have lent, but not in Europe and not in real expansion. They've sent it abroad. They've invested in U.S. securities and so forth. So we got $15 trillion in this experiment by central banks of negative rates. Total failure. Hasn't produced anything. And now, you know, more and more you see commentators saying, and bankers saying, we got to end this experiment. It clearly hasn't worked. And it hasn't. But $15 trillion in negative rates. Big run-up last year in negative rates. Another global economy over $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans. Easily over $10 trillion in Europe, in Japan, and increasingly in India. Yeah, watch India. We'll talk about that shortly. You know, $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans at a minimum. Now, some of that is, they say, has been reduced, you know, as let's take the Italian banks. What they've done is sell off some of their non-performing loans to shadow bank investors like hedge funds and so forth, who've taken them off their the bank's balance sheet, you know, UniCredit and Banco Popolare and others in Italy, taking it off their balance sheet and put it on their shadow bank balance sheet. So it looks like the non-performing bank loans aren't growing as fast in Europe. But look, you know, it doesn't matter whose balance sheet on it. If it's a non-performing loan, it's non-performing, whether it's held by UniCredit or held by, you know, some U.S. hedge fund that buys it pennies on the dollar and holds it in the hope that 5-10 years from now they'll make a killing on that as the price rises once again. That's what these shadow banks do, some of them. Okay, so, you know, this massive more than $10 trillion in NPLs. And when the crisis comes, again, financially, you know, you won't be able to dump those and sell those. Another development here in the global economy last year was signs that the parts of the global economy may be trying to get out from under the U.S. banking international payments system called SWIFT. You see, SWIFT is how banks and businesses pay each other globally in different currencies back and forth. SWIFT, really run by the U.S. and the U.S. banks, because the dollar is the dominant currency that's used in trade. But SWIFT is essential for the U.S. to see who is violating U.S. sanctions. You see, the banks can look in on the SWIFT system data and say, "Oh, you know, oh, they, you know, what's happening is Italy is buying oil from Iran. You know, you know, they can see it." Well, companies are trying, or countries rather, are trying to get out from under the SWIFT system, and Europe is working towards, I don't know if they've implemented it, an alternative independent system called INSTEX, so that they can continue trading with Iran here, even though there are sanctions, and not be seen. Okay, so that's an ominous development, and if it occurs, of course, China and Russia want to do that. If it occurs, then it's really undermining a major weapon in the U.S. Global economic empire. You know, the dollar's the big weapon, but the SWIFT system is tied in with that dollar, and sanctions, of course, and tariffs. You know, these are all weapons that are used, and if you wanted financially harm a country, you know, you U.S. takes action to undermine its currency and cause all of its import costs to rise, and adds sanctions to that, so it can't get important foodstuffs and medicines and so forth, and wreck its economy by wrecking its currency. That's a major financial imperial device. And the U.S. is able to pull it off because, you know, the dollar is the dominant currency and the SWIFT system is controlled by it. And these other international institutions are also controlled by the U.S., you know, the IMF and the World Bank, right? And by the way, on the IMF, the, you know, proof that the U.S. controls it is that we've had a shift in the in Latin America and Argentina, in the politics and political government there, back to center-left, away from Macri and the right-wing that ripped the country off in the last couple of years even further, and left the country with like $60 billion in debt, external debt as they call it, borrowing from the IMF, and they need the IMF gave them the biggest loan the IMF ever did when Macri was running. the picture, and now it's beginning to appear that the new government is balking at that massive debt, which will keep it in a depression for years to come if it agrees to continue to pay, just as Greece was allocated to that crisis for a long time, still is. But anyway, another story, it's an example of how the U.S. really runs the IMF and puts pressure on these countries. It warned Argentina, you're not going to get this loan or whatever if you don't do what we say. There's politics behind that. But what it points to is in 2019, this big problem in Latin American currencies, currency crisis, big time. Collapse of the currencies down there for various reasons, economically, rising interest rates in the U.S. And so forth. But what we got is a currency crisis. Argentine currency collapsed to like 40-50%. Chile now has collapsed significantly and falling further. I'm not sure what's happening in Brazil, of course. Venezuela and Ecuador and Bolivia and all these places, the currencies, as the crises develop politically as well as economically, tend to collapse. Okay, so Latin America currency crises last year. India, you don't get a lot of news on India, but India's in big trouble. Its GDP is slowing rapidly. It's been grossly overestimated anyway. But its shadow banks, its credit system, is getting very shaky and unstable over there. And as I said, there's a lot of non-performing loans as well. So we've got India. We've got India in trouble. Japan is stagnant, on the verge of slipping into yet another recession. South Korea is slowing. So that's a big development in 19. And, of course, the Chinese economy slowing, GDP slowing. Also, for a while, the long time, in a manufacturing recession. China continuing its efforts to deal with its shadow banking system. That's been going on since 2015 by depriving them of credit for speculative purposes, but at the same time in doing that, denying the credit slows the regular economy down. So China's been doing this whack-a-mole thing for 5 years now of turning on the money spigot, turning it off. But on net, China, massive credit injections for a long time, and the debt levels are very high there, and we're seeing signs of defaults beginning to emerge in different companies. Okay, so those are the 10 most important, I think, developments in the global economy as well. I think we'll just save it to next week to talk about technology and the developments in technology. I want to talk about two in particular in more detail, and that's what's called the really emergence here last year of what's called generative adversarial neural networks. Yeah, this is artificial intelligence, learning, machine learning of its own. And what we got here, and it takes more time to do it justice, is not just voice recognition, but voice replication. Adobe's Voco app is able to, after listening to you for 30, 40 minutes, totally reproduce anything it wants using your voice. Total reproduction of your voice. So, after 30, 40 minutes, if publicly you're online talking for that, it can falsely reflect your voice and get someone saying something on the net, that will get them arrested or worse. Yeah, they can do that now. They can set you up. And they're getting damn close on facial recognition and replication. Not recognition, replication, you see. They can soon, within another year, reproduce your voice, reproduce your face. If they want to do a false flag or something, put you up on the internet, it looks like you, it is you, it is your voice, and you can say, have you say and do things, and of course, get you arrested, right, at best. Yeah, we're almost there. in that. The other major development I think that's very ominous in tech is hypersonic missile technology. You know, Russians have it. The U.S. probably has it. If not, it's damn close. We'll have it this year. Hypersonic, in other words, some say that it's 30 times the speed of sound. 30 times. We're talking about, you know, 5,000, 25,000 miles. I'm not sure an hour. I'm not sure if that's exactly true. Massive, you can't defend against this. And particularly if you put these missiles in space, you know, now Trump wants a space program. The next step is to put hypersonic missiles in space, which are really, you know, maybe 50 miles above, if that. How fast would a missile from 50 miles up from a satellite, whatever, take to reach a target, you know, going 20,000 miles or 5,000 miles an hour, right? Figure it out. In other words, we're talking about a couple minutes, if that. Anyway, we're at the 11th hour and 59 minutes here, I think, once the hypersonic missiles from space get deployed from World War III. Yeah, we're very, very close. Very ominous. We should be very, very worried about that. And, of course, drone technology is now far beyond what they're being reported. You know, people in Nebraska are wondering, what are these drones, you know, flying around our town here? You know, well, that, of course, that's the military, right? Amazon one-day delivery going on. Amazon used to be a book company, and then a warehouse company, then a cloud computing company, and then a grocery store company, right? Now it's a delivery company, period. And recently, Amazon got rid of FedEx because FedEx can't guarantee a one-day delivery. So Amazon is destroying all these jobs everywhere and undermining, you know, along with the retail. Look, retail was the place where a lot of these contingent part-time temp jobs were hired. Now AI and Amazon are going to get rid of those. What are people going to work at? You know, they can't even get part-time temp contingent jobs, temp jobs? Yeah, that's the next decade. Yeah, I had an entire chapter, concluding chapter, on these new technologies and what they're going to do to labor markets and product markets, and how if we think we've had a crisis in the past year and past decade, we ain't seen nothing yet until 2025. Okay, well, we'll talk more about those technologies next week, and I want to talk about the 10 most important political developments in the U.S. last year and the 10 most important political developments globally last year. But we'll save that for next year. Okay, that's the end of my show today. And, well, it's going to be a hell of a year to come, isn't it? Yeah. All right. Talk to you next week.